John Dallan is one of the great English song composers. That's the first thing to say about him. He's right up there with Purcell and Lennon McCartney and Bob Dylan, those sort of people. He was also the greatest lutenist in Europe at the time, and he left us an astonishing body of work, which was incredibly famous. It made him very, very famous in his time, and has remained sung by singers of English since then until now. He was even in the 18th and 19th centuries, he was still sung. His songs were known, and the publication that we're bringing is a purely instrumental program of music for five viols and lute, which was his publication of 1604, called Lacrimae, or Seven Tears, figured in Seven Passionate Pavans. And it's a wholly remarkable publication, unique in several respects, that it's the only publication that was of music calling explicitly for viols and lute together. And it had this. It's opened with this extraordinary set of seven pavans, which are all based on his most famous tune, which was his song, "Flow My Tears." And each one of the pavans takes this tear motif, which is the beginning of the song, and uses that as the beginning of the pavan, and then works through the same material, but in a completely different way. And offers us a kind of journey, a musical, spiritual journey, really. And it goes, each of the pavans has got a different title. Lacrimae Antiquae is the first one, that's Old Tears. And then you go through Lacrimae Antiquae Novae, which is Old Tears Renewed. And then Lacrimae Gementes, which is Groaning Tears. And then we get to come to the center of the set. There's seven pavans, so this is the fourth. The middle pavan is Lacrimae Tristes, which is Sad Tears. Then comes Lacrimae Coacte, which is translated as Forced Tears, or even Crocodile Tears. Then Lacrimae Amantis, Lover's Tears. And finally, Lacrimae Verae, which is True Tears. And so there's this extraordinary journey that we're taking on, and Dowland chooses the pavan, which is the most serious of all the then current dance forms, and builds an absolutely extraordinarily intense symphony out of these seven pieces. The whole thing lasts about 25 minutes. There's no indication that he imagined that all seven would be played in one go, or that they were necessarily played to anybody else, for that matter, but there is something extremely compelling about having all seven pavans played one after the other, because you begin to notice the differences and the subtle variations within the form that he explores. But that's just half the program. The other half is the rest of the publication, which are much jollier, lighter, more lively dances, mostly galliards, which are faster and more happy pieces in that sense. So one half of it, of the program, is really intense and really rather melancholy, and the other half is, for the most part, quite up tempo, quite jolly, and quite bright.
So the Flow My Tears theme, which will penetrate the full set of pieces that are based on it. It's kind of a slow, sad theme, but you, as a musician, get to enjoy the wonderful surprises and appreciate the genius of the settings, the way he uses that theme. And while there's a sadness to the theme, I imagine there's a lot of excitement for you and for the listeners as we follow the theme.
Oh yes, absolutely. It's the way in which Dowland alters the basic plan of his opening pavan is absolutely fascinating and endlessly thrilling for us as musicians. I mean, it's very when you get to play pieces over and over again, frequently, it really sorts out the men from the boys when it comes to composition, because even a slightly less than top rate composition will begin to pall as a performer if you play it many, many times. We've been playing the Lacrimae all year because, of course, it's his 450th anniversary this year. We haven't noticed any falling off in interest of the music. It's the sort of music where the further you go into it, the more you find. Very like Bach in that respect. You can play Bach sort of endlessly and not tire of it. And Dallin's very much like that.
So he's really in a category by himself.
Yeah, yeah.
450 years is a very long time ago. And
yeah.
Would you indulge me by sort of painting a portrait of his life as a musician in that time period and some of the things that he would have been up to as a lutenist and composer?
Well, Dallin is a slightly unusual composer of the time. Most English composers at the time would have got themselves either a post in the church or a post at court. That's where the money was, and they would have led a relatively dull life, basically. So they're working as they did at the institution, producing music, playing music, writing, and that sort of thing. Dallin, on the other hand, did none of that at all. He spent his entire life wanting a position at the court in England, but not getting it until 1612, when he was quite old. And he travelled throughout Europe. He travelled in France, to Germany, many of the states in Germany, and down through Italy. And then he did get a position in Denmark, in Helsingør, with King Christian IV of Denmark. He's one of the first composers for whom we get a feeling of a very sort of willful, awkward personality, somebody who was constantly finding slights to his perceived brilliance. I mean, he was a star in that sense, and a bit of a prima donna, you feel. He was, in his introductions to his works, is where we principally get a sort of feel for him. He's constantly complaining that no one appreciates him as much as he needs to be. He is constantly saying that he has a hard life, traveling endlessly throughout Europe. And no doubt that was true. On the other hand, he was extremely well rewarded for his skills. In Denmark, he was paid twice the salary of anyone else who was working there. Some of it was a little bit hard to take, obviously. And some of his friends said that Henry Peacham was one of his friends who wrote that he slipped many a chance of advancement. In other words, if he had been a cooler head, he would have got on rather better and perhaps found his court post in England. But in a way, we ought to be grateful that he didn't get that court post, because when he did get the court post in 1612, he promptly stops writing music, or at least publishing it anyway, and he lives for another 14 years after that, but there's really nothing we hear from him after since he gets the post in England. So all this trouble and anxiety that he obviously went through were very creative, I think, ultimately for him.
And he saw so much of the world that I'm sure that had an impact as well.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, he was very much caught up in the religious conflicts of the time. He was It's very difficult to work out exactly what he was. He definitely dallied with Catholicism, but yet he was he became a doctor of music at both Oxford and Cambridge. And in order to accept his degree, he would have had to have subscribed to the 33 articles of the Protestant faith, or the Anglican faith. So he must have renounced Catholicism by then, at least. He became very worried and embroiled with a group of treasonous recusants, Catholics, in Florence when he was on his way down to Rome to meet Marenzio, the great Italian composer. And he fell in with this group of English Catholics who were plotting to murder Queen Elizabeth and put a Catholic monarch on the throne. And he sort of realized that he was in really a bad place, that this was not going to end well if he carried on like this. And so he quickly left Florence. And on his way back, he wrote a long and very interesting letter to Robert Cecil, who was the Queen's great spy master, trying to exculpate himself, saying that he was not in any way treasonous, and that even if he was Catholic, he wasn't he didn't want to have anything to do with treason or anything like that. That which didn't. I can't have helped his cause of preferment in London at all, but nevertheless, you sort of see his rather gauche attempt at justifying himself there.
Well, I feel like I could go through a whole bucket of popcorn watching this movie.
Yes, they should make one. I think it would be quite interesting. I mean, the other thing, of course, is that he is the most sought after lutenist in the world at the time, and I mean immensely famous and immensely popular. His publications went through many editions, and he was really a total star. I mean, at a time when the lute was it was the same position as probably the piano is what was in the 19th century, maybe with what the guitar is these days, but there's no doubt that he was the pinnacle of flute players at the time, and composers as well.
Well, we always hear that the 15th, 16th century was the golden age of lute music, and I guess you could say is that also true, that it was the golden age of consort music for viols, such as fretwork is?
Indeed, it was. English consort music, you can really date from about 1520 up until the 31st of August 1680. And you can be so precise because Henry Purcell finished his last four-part fantasy on the 31st of August 1680. And that was the last significant consort music written until the 20th century. So that was the and of course when Dowland was publishing his Lacrimae in 1604, that was absolutely the heyday of the viol consort. We had music by William Laws and Orlando Gibbons, the two greatest composers, and Dowland completes that picture with his collection, his one and only collection of consort music. But it was unusual that it was published because there was very little consort music that was published. It was mostly disseminated in manuscript form. So people would copy out their parts, copy from other people who'd copied their parts and so on. So publications were quite unusual. And Dowland's publication is marvelous because it's in what's called a table format. In other words, you open, it's a sort of folio size, slightly long and relatively narrow, but as you open that the page, the lute part is the central part of it, and the viols then have their parts on the edge of the page, so that the the clear implication is that the vials sit five vials around this table with the lute at one end and the vials all around. So we know the exact layout. The bass vial would be sitting opposite the lute, the treble vial to his left, the alto vial to the right, and so on, the other two on the other corners. So.
Vials are different from today's standard string instruments. They have frets, they have different voices and different string configurations?
Yes, well, the vials have six strings rather than four. The vial has a common ancestor with the guitar, hence the six strings and the frets, and the same, so very, very similar tuning, almost the same as guitar, to fourths and a third, and the same tuning as the lute as well. So there were a lot of players who played both lute and vial at the time. It was very common for that to happen. The vials was a whole family of instruments, and they were born at the end of the 15th century, about the same time that the violin family was born. Throughout the 16th century, the vials were the preferred string instrument of the era. But as the 17th century approached, the violin family started to assert itself rather more. It was a louder instrument.
It's louder. That's it. The vial has chordal capabilities. It has a bigger range. There's so much going for it.
And
it's, it almost seems like a sideways shift and not some sort of progression.
Well, it offers, and the vial offers, you could say more subtlety, a more subtle sound, a more homogeneous sound between the members of the family. But the violin family ultimately offered more brilliance and more volume. And in some ways, you could see the history of music as being a one long crescendo, going from. So when you get today's stadium rock concerts playing to, you know, tens of thousands of people, that's the result of a progression that started back in the 14th, 15th century with instruments getting louder and playing to more people.
So this warm, soft, almost crystalline purity that comes in your viol consorts goes out of favor and fashion and goes away for a few hundred years.
Yes.
When does it pick up again, and was there a written record saying how to play the music and what it should sound like, and how do you figure out the practice?
Yes. Well, it's interesting. I mean, the vial itself as an instrument, as the decades go on in the 17th century, becomes less a consort instrument and more a solo instrument, and it's the bass vial that becomes the main solo instrument in the 18th century. I mean, for a long time, it was thought that at the end of the 18th century, the vial was put aside completely and nobody played it at all. But recent research has shown that there were amateur players in London and in other parts of Europe who kept on playing the vial throughout the 19th century. But they played it in a very bastardized form. There were very often cellists who were playing it very much like a cello, they would take the frets off. They would use the overhand bow of the cello rather than the underhand bow of the vial, and really just treat it as a cello with six strings rather than a vial in itself. And it was really Arnold Dolmetsch who began to understand what the vial was, and began to rediscover the music that was written for it. Curiously, in the 19th century, the people who played the vial didn't play vial music on it. They played the contemporary music of the time, 19th century music, on the vial. They didn't seem to be interested in the earlier music. But Dolmetsch really did become interested in earlier music, and it was that interest that led him to the instrument. And he wanted to find out what instruments it was playing this music. And Dolmetsch was an immensely influential figure, particularly in England, And he, followers of Dolmetsch, you know, during the 20th century, became ever more interested in the English consort music of the time. It has a lot of advantages for amateur musicians because it doesn't require a sort of monumental technique to play it, and it's very sociable music. It's very, very good to play, very nice to play, very rewarding to play, and so it became more and more popular through the century, and now we have in a situation where we really have a very good knowledge of what music there was and what the best music there was. I mean, and much of the music has been dug out of libraries and published now, so it's available for anyone to play. So we're coming to the end of the period of rediscovery, and we're beginning to think about more aesthetic questions about what the music means and so on. But fretwork itself, alongside all that playing of 16th, 17th century music, we've been very keen to get contemporary composers to write for us. And so for the last 20-something years, we've been asking the best composers today to write us music as well. And that's been a wonderful addition to our repertory.
You've produced quite a number of absolutely eye-opening, beautiful recordings that we have in our record library from Virgin Classics. And that's what got all of us announcers here very excited when we heard that fretwork was coming to Kalamazoo.
Oh, great.
Your music precedes you.
And, great.
Have you been a member of fretwork for a long time?
Yes, I'm the sole remaining founder member of the group, yes, I'm still here. But
how many young viol players are being trained today and out there?
Well, curious enough, we just finished. I teach at the Royal College of Music in London here, and we have every year a 2-day festival of the viol and its music, and we have lectures and masterclasses, and we invite a guest player to come and play and teach. And I have to say, it's always wonderful and remarkable to see each year there are players who come along who I haven't seen before, I haven't heard before, who are extremely good players of the instrument. And of course, it comes and goes in waves in a way. But at the moment, there's a big interest in the instrument, and lots of young players taking up the instrument and doing tremendous things with it. It's a very exciting time to be a viol player.
And how is the worldwide gut string supply doing?
Well, it's good, actually. I mean, again, that's much better than it ever has been. Getting gut strings. Gut strings, small, thin gut strings for the top of the small strings has always been relatively straightforward. But the technology for making the big, thick gut strings for the basses has been an ongoing research project, in a way, for many, many makers all over the world, several fine makers in the States as well. Experimenting with how to twist gut and dry it and you know, do all the things that they do with it in order to make the bottom of the instruments work well, because metal strings, or even just putting metal on top of gut, was not something that was done until about 1670, something like that. That was probably the earliest occasion that happened. So in Dowland's time, everybody played on purely gut strings, even the lute players. And finding the way to make those larger gut strings work has been a very long journey, and I don't think we were quite there yet, actually.
Well, it's been a real pleasure talking to you, Richard, and having Fretwork come to Kalamazoo is a rare treat for all of us. So thank you very much.
Not at all. Well, we look forward very much to coming.